and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 22nd of October 2021, and you're listening to me, Svenna Longshanks, and we are streaming live tonight, so this is one of our live shows, so if you would like to join us, you're welcome to join us in the chat room. We are now up to episode 17 in our series, where we look at the white contribution to civilization throughout history, and tonight we're going to be looking at the Tell El Amarna letters, and of course I do have with me tonight my co-host, the patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community, or collective. It's the community, isn't it, patriarch? Anyway, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. It's Patriotic Arts Community.
I'm so. Always getting it confused with the collective as well, the White Art Collective. That's the one. So how is that going anyway? Is it going well?
I think so, yeah. We've been doing it, well, I think we've had about 7 months so far, 6 or 7. This month's theme, we're doing a spooky European legends. So you see how it turns out. Not so many entries this month, maybe it's not a popular topic, but yeah, it will be all right.
I'd forgotten about that. It's Halloween coming up, and we might actually get on to Tutankhamun tonight, the famous mummy. But we're going to begin by talking about these Tell El Amarna letters. And just before we get into that, I want to talk a little bit about sun worship, because last week we covered the city of Akhetaten and the worship of the sun that Akhenaten introduced that was rejected by the people after he died. And I do not believe our ancestors were ever so stupid as to worship the sun. Most uses of it were as a symbol for the eye of God watching our every move. As such, it also became a symbol for royalty, and over the years it has evolved into the eye of Ra, and finally into the eye on the top of the pyramid that the Masons use. What is commonly referred to as a sun cross does not look to me to be emblematic of the sun at all, but of the world itself. It shows the four directions that we can move about in, up, down, and side to side. Being thankful for the sun returning and celebrating at different times of the year related to the sowing and harvesting of crops is a different matter to being sun worshippers. Sun worship nearly always goes with human sacrifice and is something that the non-civilized races were indulging in when we discovered them. We had more sense than that, and we knew that the sun was under God's ordinances the same as everything else in the world. The heretic pharaoh Akhenaten was involved in sun worship, and to do so, he had to first get rid of all the old priests. He also used a lot of black propaganda, erecting images everywhere, showing him playing happy families and stuffing his face at banquets, while thousands of children were actually starved to death working as slaves for him, and their remains have been found by his city of gold. After he died, the Egyptians defaced every image of him that they could find and tried to wipe him out from history entirely. And I think this really shows what we used to think of sun worship. So I don't think we can confuse, celebrating the time of year because we've got the harvesting going on, but I don't think we ever saw the sun as a deity that we should be worshipping, that the sun gave us life. Do you?
No, I don't think so. I think you're quite on the money there with what it refers to. And even the symbol, the sun cross symbol, it definitely looks more like it relates to the seasons, and it's rooted in the swastika, I think, is rooted in the same symbol, isn't it? Which I think, as an ancient symbol was before Germany adopted it, it was typically associated with the circle of life, in the four seasons. So yeah, I think it's definitely, and since we were very much, into agriculture, we would have definitely paid homage to the sun in that respect of how we used it for sustenance.
Yeah, we would have been grateful for it, but we understood that there was something else that actually gave us life. I think the swastika is symbolic of movement, isn't it, and growing out in a spiral, and they would have noticed that the stars were moving in a similar spiral across the skies above them around a point in the center. So I think that's more what the swastika was associated with, just growth and cycles. So I think it was just a symbol for life itself, the swastika. Yeah. And yeah, and the sun cross is something similar. But then when we look at the Aztecs and the Mayans with their sun worship, it was all about human sacrifice. And also you think when we have our Christmas festival, it's when the sun is at its lowest. We get the least amount of sun, and yet that is the time when we're giving out presents and it's peace on earth and goodwill to everybody, and there's actually the least amount of sun. And then when you've got lots of sun in the middle of the summer, there's a lot of licentiousness goes on, a lot of drinking, rowdy behavior. You get all of that in the summer. You don't get it in the winter when you don't get so much sun. So it's it's like the two opposites, as it were, sun worship and not sun worship. And I think the black sun actually plays into this, but maybe we'll get into that in a later episode. I just wanted to bring that up basically because Akhenaten was a sun worshipper, and obviously the Egyptians completely rejected that, and they totally wiped out all memory of him for the future. And we actually heard nothing. We knew nothing about Akhenaten. We knew nothing about Akhetaten until about 150 years ago. In 1887, Egyptian Arabs were digging around the Amarna Mound, which was in reality the ruins of Akhenaten's city that had been lost to time, and they discovered clay tablets with correspondence on them from the Canaanite kings that were by now vassals of the Egyptians, written to the pharaoh. These letters were pleading with him to help them fight a new tribe who had appeared, named the Hebiru. These were very likely the Hebrews, and their leader, who is mentioned in the letters, was most likely Joshua of biblical fame. They're quite interesting, these letters. They are written in the Akkadian language rather than actually being written in Egyptian. So they and the Egyptians were understanding them, and there are also letters from Babylon as well, the king from Babylon. There's a whole lot of them. You can actually look them up on Wikipedia. And we're particularly going to look at the ones from the Canaanites here. And as we said in the last episode, the Canaanites were the Hyksos, and they'd been kicked out of Egypt, and they'd been conquered basically by Egypt. So they were vassal states to Egypt, and Egypt was on the rise. It had quite a large empire at this time. And these tablets that were found, they're originally found by some Arabs, and then Flinders Petrie went in there, the great British archaeologist, and he was the guy that found all the rest of them, and it really made a name for him. He was quite an amazing guy, Flinders Petrie. We might do an episode on him. For a while, I wanted to do a series on all our ancient archaeologists and Egyptologists, because they were all nationalists. They all understood the importance of ethnicity, and they understood that the people that they were finding the evidence of back there in history, they understood that they were white, and the stuff that Flinders Petrie was actually finding, it was in such a bad state, he said this has to be removed from Egypt, because within years it's just going to end up being destroyed by these people. They got no respect for it whatsoever, and that's why we've got so much in our museum basically. And of course they're saying today, we should give it back, but we brought it back because it would have been ruined if it had been left where it was.
Well, yeah, especially in Islamic states, they have no respect for ancient culture, history, anything which doesn't kind of align with their worldview just gets destroyed, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, they see it as idolatry. I mean, we even had the problem with the Greek marbles. That's why we've got the Greek marbles, because they weren't showing any respect for that. And they do now, because they understand how much worth there is really to white people as tourists that want to go over there and look at it. But I think that's more why these other ethnicities keep a hold of these things, and also because they like to portray it as if it was them that actually created them. Remember when we looked at the Indus Valley civilization and the relics from that, the Pakistanis and the Indians, they very, very zealously guard these now and claim that they were in actual fact them, when we know that that isn't actually true, but it gives them something to be puffed up about, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, I've got some quotes here about these letters, and they actually come from E. Raymond Capps' book, Biblical Antiquities, and it's book two. And I really do recommend E. Raymond Capps' work for looking at history and also for looking at the way that it connects to the Bible. And basically, I've paraphrased a section here from book two of Biblical Antiquities. And it says the letters cover the period from 1360 to 1330 BC, and among them is the first historical reference outside of the Old Testament to Jerusalem. And they name the enemies attacking the Canaanites as both Saga and Habiru. The word Saga, according to George Rawlinson, the professor of ancient history at the University of Oxford, is the same word as Saka on the Behistun rock in Iran, which we know is referring to the Israelites, as it is also translated into Gemiru, which is just Comri in Assyrian, and Comri being the name for the Israelites, named after the house of Omri, after their king, Omri. And we haven't really spoken much about this Behistun rock. It's written in three different translations, and it has Habiru, Saka, and Gomri for the people that are there. And the people that they're actually talking about are in the specific area that the tribes of Israel were removed to at exactly the time that the tribes of Israel were actually removed from their land in Israel. And they went on from there. They moved from there. We can trace them into Europe. And this is where the word Scythian comes from. It's from this Saka that's up there on this on this Behistun rock, yeah. or the Saga.
And Saka, and that's got its roots in sort of Isaac, isn't it? Do you think? Is it sons of Sack? Sons of Isaac.
That is a very common belief about it. I have heard other ways to tie it to the Israelites, but yeah, a lot of people believe that the Saka is referring to Isaac. Because it says in the Bible that in Isaac shall thy name be known, the people of Isaac. And then, of course, you get Saxons as well from the Scythians. It's similar sounding, Saka, before you get to the Sicathian, and then Saka sons. It's the same word at the beginning. And also these Saka, they also went east, and that's where we got Buddhism from. Buddha was a member of the Saka tribe. Sakamuni,
really?
I think it was. Yeah. Perhaps we'll do some on that as well.
Yeah, that would be interesting because, the earliest depictions of Buddha were typically a blue-eyed white man. But obviously later, due to cultural assimilation, I guess, they just mimics the appearance of the people there now.
Yeah, they had red hair and blue eyes because we had one group of the Scythians or the Saka that went to the east. They went into India and then down into Indochina and then eventually into China. And then we had another group that went west and headed into Europe and became the Saxons. And the ones that headed out into the east, eventually they became blended in with the peoples that were already out there in the east, but they brought Buddhism with them, which appeared, I think, around about the 5th century, the 6th century. And Buddhism, it was all talking about losing everything. There's one book, I can't remember the name of it, and they found a lot of rock inscriptions in India, and it appeared to be describing the destruction of Israel when the Assyrians came in and losing everything. And it was some very, very early Buddhist texts, basically. And they also had the lion and the unicorn and a Union Jack that was carved into this rock. And not new, I mean, from years ago. They're saying this is where our symbolism for the Union Jack actually came from. I'm trying to think of the name of the book.
There are actually, I know Christianity came after, but obviously it's rooted, would have been rooted in the sort of Old Testament or from the same people, obviously it sprang out of. But if you look at Christianity and some Buddhist teachings in terms of the sentiment of, abstinence of and putting away the worldly kind of association and the flesh, you know, being rooted in the spirit. There are a lot of similarities between Buddhism and Christianity in many ways.
Definitely, renunciation of worldly pleasures and materialism, and it was a Scythian prince that came up with these ideas, and he was the first Buddha. But it was basically it's the same word, Sakka, Saga, and this has been confirmed by George Rawlinson. So in these letters, they're calling them both Saga, and they're also calling them Habiru, and I think this is the first time that the word Habiru had been found anywhere. It's spelt differently to Hebrew, but it's essentially the same word as H-A-B-I-R-U. And the Amarna letters show that during the reign of Amenophis IV, that's Akhenaten, there were in each of the cities of Canaan an Egyptian official known as a Paka, who was presumably there to guard Egypt's interests. In the reign of Amenophis III, the Canaanites had plotted against their Egyptian conquerors, and we know that Amenophis knew about this because it is mentioned in one of the letters from the Pakas that the Canaanites had previously tried to persuade the Babylonians to join them in an uprising against Egypt. And that's really a sort of suggested reason as to why the Egyptians didn't help. Because this is a big question that people have that don't really follow the Bible and the biblical interpretation, and they don't understand why it was that the Pharaoh didn't go and help the Canaanites when they were being attacked by these Habiru. But you've got to remember that this is only less than one generation since the Exodus of the Old Testament, when the Pharaoh was destroyed in the Red Sea, and there were all these plagues beforehand. So that would be a very compelling reason for the Pharaoh of Egypt not to go and fight against, you know, the same people that were going into Canaan. Another letter from this king of Babylon warns Amenophis of the Habiru, who were invading Palestine at that time. He writes, "Canaan is in your land. You are the king. I have been violently dealt with in your land. Subdue them. If you do not kill these people, they will come again. And my caravans and even your messengers, they will kill. The trade between us will be cut off, and the land's inhabitants will become hostile to you." To all these pleas, the Pharaoh was deaf. Although the cities were tributaries to him, he simply left them to their fate, possibly because he had been told what had happened to his relative drowning in the sea with his chariots when the Habiru left Egypt. And I think that's a pretty compelling theory to have, because these cities were paying him, they were tributaries to him, and he just showed no interest. I don't think he even bothered replying to the letters. He just sort of left them to their fate.
Right. Well, yeah, it would make sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
To see the back of them after all the plagues and all the chaos that they brought, they'd probably glad to see the back of them. Really, they wouldn't want to get involved, would they?
No, well, they wouldn't want to fight against them. They certainly wouldn't want to fight against these people.
Another point. What happened in terms of their time in the wilderness, the Hebrews, when they left Egypt? They had time in the wilderness before going into Canaan, though, right?
Yeah.
So it would have been, you say, a generation after. So that,
well, 40 years
would be about right, wouldn't it?
Yeah, 40 years. Yeah. I mean, that's what I was saying about a generation. 40 years is how long they were in the wilderness.
And then they probably would have kind of settled and expanded a bit as well, right?
And training, and training as well, and and preparing, really, sort of preparing for this invasion and going in at the right time.
So, in some roundabout way, although in the Bible the wilderness was a kind of it puts it in a frame of a kind of not being so focused, or you know, kind of wandering in a way. The way I'd always learned it was the wilderness was a time of going around in circles and not quite being on God's path. But in the end, that it was probably necessary in order to grow and be able to and end up taking Canaan, right?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure they were sort of going around in circles. I mean, I guess that's one way to put it. But if you have animals with you, and that you're grazing in one area, you've got to move them from one field to the next, haven't you? So you would move from one area to the next with their cattle and with their sheep, because don't forget that's what they were. They were sheep and cattle farmers. And they would have been training, and they'd been told not to go in until a certain point, and it was a punishment, I believe.
Yeah.
Can't recall exactly what for. It might have been the golden calf or trying to go in there beforehand, but they were told you have to wait 40 years and then you can go in. And they obeyed. And when they went in, they smited everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another puzzling aspect to the letters, and this is that they mention the Amorites as invading, saying, "All who are in the land of the Amorites are gathering, and I am being attacked." A second letter from the same ruler reads, "Who is Abdasharah? A slave, a dog, but send reinforcements. Abdasharah has conquered beyond the land of the Amorites. Also, since the time of your father, the city of Sidon has submitted to the occupation by his allies. The land is for the men of blood. So now there is none who is a friend to me. Let the king regard this message." And Abdasharah sounds like Joshua, doesn't it? Dasharah, Joshua.
Yeah.
Does sound similar. So. The Canaanites did not appear to know who this Abdasharah was, as is the case with many biblical scholars today. However, when we compare the information on the tablets with the biblical record, it is quite possible that Abdasharah was simply the Canaanite name for Joshua. Just who his allies were is an interesting question. It is likely they were a contingent of the Israelites from the land of the Amorites, who instead of crossing the Jordan River with Joshua's army, had attacked Phoenicia from the north. And we'll see why that is in a sec. Additional evidence that Abdasharah was Joshua is found in another letter which questions who set him up. What mighty Saka man set him up? As the expression Saka also meant Hebrew, the question is asking what mighty Hebrew man had set him up. The mighty man who set him up was Moses. Because Joshua was who Moses appointed, wasn't he, to lead them into the promised land. Well, the land of the Amorites had actually become the possession of the Israelites by this time. And we can read that in Numbers chapter 21. When the Hebrew came out of the desert, they had to pass through the land of the Amorites to get to Canaan. And they offered to pass through peacefully. And they promised not to touch the crops or even the wells and just use the king's highway. But the Amorites fought them instead and were completely destroyed by the Hebrews, who took all their cities as booty after expelling them all from the land. And that's actually quite a famous bit in the Bible where they send messages to the king and they say, "Look, we need to pass through your land. We won't touch any of the crops. We won't touch the wells. We just want to use the king's highway. We just want to be unmolested and pass through." And the Amorites fancied their chances, only they ended up getting smited.
What's the lineage of the Amorites? Do you know if they connected more closely to the Canaanites or other kind of white civilization?
I would have to do extra research, but to remind myself. But we did cover the Amorites in the second or the third episode. I think they did look white, and the depictions of them say that they're blue eyed and blonde haired. But I think there had been some interaction with the Canaanites, or that they may have been Canaanites. It may even be that the pictures of the Amorites were actually of the Israelites, because what's just happened now is the Israelites have taken over that country. They've wiped out the Amorites. They've executed them or kicked them out, and they've then taken that country. And what seems to happen is when people move into a country, they take the name of the country instead of retaining the name of their ethnicity, which is the same problem that we have today. Everyone that comes into Britain just calls themselves British and becomes a citizen, and they're all called British, whereas their ethnicity might not be British. And what you've got here is you've got Israelites moving into the land of the Amorites, and then they would then be called Amorites, and that is what happened. The Canaanites then referred to the people coming from that land as Amorites.
Yeah, I guess if you're losing the title, it's worse off. But if you're gaining the title, it's more of a trophy, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's also the bit about Moab, the land of Moab. The Israelites also went into the land of Moab, and they expelled all the Moabites, and they took the country over. And I think 100 years later, something like that, we hear or we read about Ruth in the Bible. And it tells us Ruth was a Moabitess and she came from the land of Moab. She was an Israelite. She could not have actually been a Moabite because the Israelites had taken the country over 100 years previously. So what it was saying is that was the country that Ruth originated from. She was an Israelite. She wasn't actually a Moabite by ethnicity, and that was why she was able to marry into the Israelites. Otherwise, she would have been the daughter of a strange god, and it would have been against the law.
I think that's where a lot of doctrines are twisted up, because it enables the doctrines of sort of universalism and just opens the whole thing up, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, well, a lot of confusion has come in because of that. And people will say, oh, no, it's absolutely fine. If you follow the religion, then you can marry into the covenant. And that's not actually so. And the history tells us that she can only have been an Israelite, and it's referring to her as a Moabite because that was the land that she came from. So, of course, that's why she's worshipping the same God. That's why she's able to marry into the line of Judah, I think it was, that Ruth married into. Well, it was from the land of the Amorites that the Israelites passed over the Jordan and attacked the Canaanites on the coast, which explains why the letters thought they were Amorites. Strangely, Bible commentaries do not mention that the Israelites also took Sidon and Tyre, but in the 11th chapter of Joshua, we learn how the Hebrews chased the armies of the northern Canaanites right up to Sidon and utterly destroyed them. These armies were the last of the Canaanite military, and certainly the tribe of Asher, who had been allotted these two cities, would have gone ahead and occupied them as foretold and promised to them. And the Armana letters actually confirm this with a letter from Zimrida, the ruler of Sidon, saying, "Behold, my cities, which the king has given into my hands, have fallen to the Hebrew." Another letter explains how Zimrida himself had capitulated to the Hebrew, and that many of his people had escaped into the mountains. This corroborates Joshua chapter 13, where it says the Sidonians were living in the hill country. Another letter from Tyre says that some important people fled to escape slavery, which agrees with the Bible, that says the ones remaining were made to do task work by the Israelites, something which broke God's commandment but fulfilled Noah's curse on Canaan to be a slave to his brothers. And that's something we pointed out when we talked about Canaan as well, that this curse that was actually put on Canaan, that he would be a slave, it meant that the Israelites would break God's commandment, but that the curse would then be fulfilled, strangely enough.
And just for anyone that didn't catch the other episode, we also mentioned about how it wasn't Ham, the son of Noah, that was cursed. It was Canaan, Ham's son, because Canaan was essentially the unlawful offspring as a result of his incestuous relationship with Noah's wife.
Yes, that's what it means. I forget what the terminology was. To
uncover his father's nakedness.
That's it. Yeah. He uncovered his father's nakedness. Ham uncovered his father's nakedness. And in Leviticus, it tells you that to uncover somebody's nakedness means to have relations with their wife. So that's why Canaan was cursed. Sometimes my mind just goes a blank. Thanks for reminding me of that one. It was only after this point that this area became known as Phoenicia, and the Phoenician Empire began, which was effectively just another name for the Israelite Empire. This is why the kings of Sidon and Tyre were allied with Solomon and helped build his temple. They were Israelite kings. We will cover Phoenicia in a separate episode, but for now we will go back to the pharaohs that came after Akhenaten. Unless there's anything else you want to add to this bit on the Tel Amarna letters, Patriarch.
There was a point I wanted to make about the tribe of Asher and just the geographical location. Obviously, they took Sidon and Tyre, and that's pretty much the coastland region, isn't it, in the north of where that land is. Yeah, so that explains why they were linked heavily to the trade routes you know, in the previous history with the tin trade that we were talking about before.
Yeah, they were the ones that were involved in that. That's prime port land, basically, so that you can just push the boats off and head off into the Mediterranean. So they then became very big cities of commerce and merchants. And it was Asher. And I think there's mention, is it the ships of Asher and the something or other of Dan? Were Dan involved as well?
Yeah, I think Danites as well, because they were seafaring, weren't they? And
yeah.
Another point we've mentioned, but if you ever compare the Phoenician ships and the typical Viking ships, they're just it's uncanny resemblance, you know.
I bet.
Another point I wanted to make, in terms of as a people, you know, anyone that might, you know, hold to the view that the Hebrews were essentially the Jews, I mean, when we're looking at the past history and how they were in terms of like a warlike people that would go in and just conquer lands, you know, we mentioned how the Jews have always typically been merchants, and you know, even going back to the earliest civilizations, and they haven't really changed today. And it reading these stories and this history, it just doesn't, you wouldn't associate a warmongering people with them at all. If anything, you know, they're definitely more reminiscent of our people.
Yeah, the Jews are very timid people. They're not warriors. You know, they have other ways of gaining influence and power. I mean, it is fascinating the way that the different ethnicities do go about gaining influence and power, and we would go in there and conquer and take over, but the Jews, where they're a small minority living amongst another majority, they've got other ways of doing it, and they are a very timid people. So they do all these surveys to find out how much people like them and to see what the levels of anti-Semitism are. They're very concerned about these things. You're right, they're not the sort of people that would you know, conquer these countries like this by sheer force of being warriors and advanced weaponry and technology and being incredibly fit as well. Mm-hmm. So it does highlight that. But getting back to this now we're moving to Tutankhamun, probably the most famous of the pharaohs. The subsequent pharaohs, Tutankhamun A and Horemheb, worked to erase all mention of Akhenaten's heresy, which is now known to us as the Amarna period. So Tutankhamun came after Akhenaten, and he was originally called Tutankhaten, and he changed his name as soon as Akhenaten was gone. He changed his name to Tutankhamun because they were worshipping Amun again, who was the god that the Egyptians wanted to worship, not this new idea of worshipping the sun, which was the equivalent of atheism, because he got rid of all the old priests. So we finish with the Amarna period, which was with Akhenaten, and we move into Tutankhamun, the boy king, who died when he was 18. He reigned around 1350 BC, 20 years after the Amarna letters were written. Although he died too young to become a pharaoh of any great significance in his own time, he gained fame when his tomb was discovered intact in 1924, one of the few tombs to be found in such a good state, as most had been the subject of grave robbers centuries before. And it is the gold burial mask of Tutankhamun which has come to symbolise ancient Egypt. And again, so this shows us what the Egyptians thought of these old tombs and these pyramids. They just wanted to break into them and steal everything that was in there. They didn't see the value of it being so old. If it was gold, they just wanted to melt it down.
Yeah.
However, the real significance of the artifacts in the tomb has been largely ignored. Amongst Tutankhamun's possessions were some of the most graphic racial images in all Egyptology. One of Tutankhamun's thrones, the ecclesiastical chair, has on its footrest the nine bows, the Egyptian name for the traditional enemies of Egypt. The finely crafted figures on the footrest are of nine blacks and Arabs, tied together in chains. They were positioned on the footrest so that when the pharaoh sat on his throne, his enemies would be under his heel. Another graphically racial image found in Tutankhamun's tomb is found on one of his walking sticks. The handle is made up of a bound Arab and a bound black, so that when the Egyptian king went for a walk with his royal walking stick, he held the enemies of Egypt in his hand. So a lot of symbolism here going on. Yet another candid racial image from Tutankhamun's tomb is found in a pair of his sandals. Inlaid with a picture of an Arab on one sole and a black on the other, the pharaoh would trample his enemies underfoot when he walked. And it's actually an Arab and a black on each sole. It's got both of them, one facing either way, that were under his feet. So he had them in his hand and under his feet when he walked. Tutankhamun's famous wooden chest, which was found in the antechamber of his tomb, contains yet another striking scene. On its side, it shows the Egyptian king riding a chariot and trampling the enemies of Egypt. And once again, they are blacks and Arabs. These enemies were the Nubians to the south and the Hyksos to the north, with the Nubians now known to us as blacks and the Hyksos as Arabs. Even by Tutankhamun's time then, the Egyptians were still well aware of the threat that these two groups posed to them, even though both groups had eventually been defeated and made into vassal states. These graphic references to Egypt's enemies are rather ominous when it is considered that by the time of Tutankhamun, slaves made from both these ethnicities had already become commonplace. And within a few hundred years, interbreeding with them had completely weakened the Egyptians to such a state that they themselves were going to be vassal people from then on. They would be ruled by other peoples that had retained their ethnic integrity. Well, yeah, most people aren't aware of all these images that there are within his tomb that really sort of graphically depict this.
I haven't actually seen them. How is it? Is it the colorings that's depicted as, or is it the engravings kind of actually describing them in a written form?
No, they're anatomically correct. You would be able to tell what race they were without coloring, basically, by the facial features, by the proportions. They're very detailed, and they show Arabs and blacks and I think back then at the time, I mean we're calling them Arabs, but they were Hyksos, they were Canaanite people. You can trace the particular features of Canaanites back to the Hittites, and you can still see that distinctive nose in Jews today, and you can see that in this image there, and it's a similar nose to an Arab's nose. Back then, Arabs, they were named after the area Arabia, and it comes from the word Ereb, a Hebrew word Ereb, which means mixed race. Actually, if you look on the Bible Concordance, it says mongrel race, and it also means to darken, like when the sun goes down, and it also means to mix warp and woof together, to mix two different kinds of cotton or thread together. So it's essentially saying a mixed race, and that's what Arabs were, and the land Arabia came from this word Arab, meaning the land where these Arabs were. But I'm not sure that they were that mixed back then, to be honest, because
not so mixed probably. I mean, even up to the time of Muhammad, they would have been quite fair skinned, wouldn't they? Because we know there's descriptions of Muhammad being fair-skinned. And also even the Quran itself depicts Jesus as being a reddish white man with lank hair, red hair, I think. So, you know, if a religion such as Islam is trying to pass off itself as a legitimate religion, it's going to want to describe the figure of Christ as close as possible or as genuine as possible to for people to believe it. So you can only assume that if they're describing Jesus as white, then, you know, around that area, it must have been still relatively white.
Yeah, they must be relatively white themselves. I think when you look at the old paintings of the Moors from 800 years back, 900 years back, they look very white as well. this real sort of darkening didn't occur until really in the last 1,000 years, 1,500 years. And also in Arabia, you had these different tribes. So they weren't known as Arabs. They might have been in the land that was known as Arabia, but you did have different tribes there. You had some groups that were called Arabs. There's a reference when the Israelites actually come out of Egypt, and when it's translated in the Bible, and it says, and a mixed multitude went with them. The word that is translated as mixed multitude is actually Arab. So by a mixed multitude, it meant a multitude of mixed race peoples also followed them out. And when they were in the wilderness for that 40 years, that's when they would have, the mixed multitude would have left them as well. Because that multitude would have been coming along thinking, what are we going to get? And the Israelites didn't get anything. They just stayed there for 40 years. So the mixed multitude would have gone off somewhere else, I suspect. So that's another reason for them waiting before they went into Canaan. And also we heard that Joktan, who was related to Job, who was a Shemite, came in to build the Great Pyramid from Arabia. He was in that direction of the land that we now call Arabia. So there may have been different tribes that were actually living in that area. The same as you got Joseph and his people and the Israelites were living in and Abraham were living in Canaan for a while amongst the Canaanites, and they were told not to do the same as the Canaanites, but to live there for a while. So you had different tribes that would travel about and move about. That's why it was so important to remember your ethnicity. That's why they have all these family trees, and this is the son of the son of the son of the son of the son, and that's telling them who they are, what their inheritance is, what their heritage is, what the promises to their fathers were. And it's not based on what land they're living in. It's all based on who they are, who their ancestors were. That's what makes them, and that's what gives them their legitimacy as well.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, caste systems played a massive role because that was integral to the culture, really, wasn't it, in terms of lineage? You know, if something was promised to you, it's cast down to you as well. It's everything was very regimented and passed on through the seed through offspring.
Massively. I was just thinking about caste today, actually. It's a little bit off topic, but I was thinking when we had the caste system, I don't think there would have been a chance for there to be genetic defects and disease. Well, there wouldn't have been genetic defects, and anybody that was born that was weakly would have died very quickly because of all these childhood diseases. So the people that actually grew up to adulthood, they would have been very strong and very sturdy. They would have been the best examples that we actually have of our people. And with the caste system in place and people marrying within their caste, there wouldn't have been any chance for disease to really take over. And I think that's why we don't hear of a massive medical industry back then. And then you look at it today and you look at the size of the NHS and everything that is involved in that and how they're worrying that it's going to crash this winter, and we have all these waiting lines to queues to have operations, 6 month waiting lists and all of this. And you just think, well, they had none of that in the ancient world, and yet they still managed to survive. And I think it must have been because they still had the caste system back then, and they hadn't allowed the mixing between the castes and they hadn't kept the weak people alive to breed and to introduce genetic weakness into the nation. I mean, it's great. We have medicine today, but by sort of helping the weak to live back then in the past, it introduced that into the nation and meant that we have all sorts of diseases now and that people can catch and that people can be born with.
Yeah, definitely. I remember Ed Dutton spoke about mutants and through the aid of medicine and medical interventions, we've essentially saved a lot of people that nature didn't necessarily intend to breed. And so they're passing on the genes, which are a bit more defective, and therefore we're becoming less less rigid and solid in our immunity to things. But I think also was in our society today, we're heavily poisoned as well in terms of our diet. And so this contributes to disease and breakdown of the body. So I'd say it's a mix of the two, contributing factors.
Yeah, and the mutational load, it doesn't just reflect itself in asymmetrical features and weakness to disease. It also means that you end up with maladaptive ideas as well, and you don't think in the mm-hmm. right way. So that's where a lot of these harmful ideas that have been introduced into the nation, that's where they come from. They're from mm-hmm. people that aren't, sort of really 100%. Professor Dutton's theories suggest that 90% of the people alive today wouldn't have made it past childhood 150 years wow. ago. So that gives you an idea of just how many people there are that are like that. And that's why people go along with left-wing progressive ideas that can only end up in harming the nation. It's like yeah. feminism, within 150 years, feminism could just end up with doing away with the entire nation. Because the women will just yeah. stop breeding because they want to work. It's not an idea that is conducive to the health of the group. It's quite a selfish idea. Yeah, a lot of these ideas are based on selfishness rather than putting the group first. And years ago, you understood that you had to put the group first because you relied on the group for everything. If you were put outside of the group and you were made into an outlaw, you were stuffed. You're not going to be able to survive. Well, talking of genetics, up to 70% of British men and half of all Western European men are related to the Egyptian pharaoh Tutankhamun, according to geneticists in Switzerland. Their results show that King Tut belongs to a genetic profile group known as haplogroup R1B1A2. To which more than 50% of all men in Western Europe belong, indicating that they all share a common ancestor. But among modern-day Egyptians, this haplogroup contingent is below 1%, according to iGenia. After these results were published and requests were made for the Y-DNA tests, all further results have been shut away from the public. They don't want us to know. And I'm sure there's probably more on this because I've read before quite a bit of detail on these genetic tests that they've actually done on Tutankhamun and showing that Europeans are the closest to him. But, I mean, what they're saying here, 70% of British men are related to Tutankhamun.
Yeah, that is interesting. I just wonder what percentage of the overall DNA is similar. Would there be another mixing? I mean, was he mixed race? If you know what I mean, maybe. I don't know if what the facts were.
Well, that's it, isn't it? I mean, he might have been if he had come from Akhenaten, because Akhenaten was clearly mixed race, and he had Hurrian heritage from the Hurrians, who were Canaanites. So yeah, that's probably why it's not 100% of British men is because there is a percentage of Canaanite in there. I would suggest.
Well, I think even if he was say mixed race, but through his line was half white, I think there would still be a connection there, wouldn't there? Regardless. I think that the main point here is that there is a connection, a genetic connection, especially given the fact that most people think Europeans or whites of the world today have no place in Egypt or have no history in Egypt. But this kind of proves that whites essentially were in and around Egypt at that point in time. They had to have been. There's a connection, physical connection.
Yeah, much more of a connection than the Egyptians that are there now have exactly. to the ancient Egyptians. I mean, if there's just 1%, that haplogroup is below 1% amongst the people that are there now, and that's the main one that they are identified by. But you can also look at the mummies, and you can see the mummies have got red hair, and they tried to come up with an excuse for that, and they said, that was just time, or it was a dye from the embalming process or whatever. And they've discovered that that's not true now. They are blonde and red hair that these mummies had. There's some other really interesting mummies as well in the Tarim Basin in China, which is probably going to be the next one that we do after doing this series on Egypt. And she's definitely Caucasian. And that's the I think that's the oldest body that we've actually got that we've recovered. And she's clearly Caucasian. And she's up in the Tarim Basin on the way to China from, I think, 1500 BC.
I've seen that. I think you can definitely see a lot of influence in some Chinese. I mean, they are quite fair-skinned, aren't they? And if you look at some of the surrounding nations, like Mongolia, for example, you get a wide variety of that kind of Mongolian type, phenotype, and Chinese seem to be the fairer of most of them, at least some in the kind of villages and outbacks look a bit darker, but there's... I think you definitely see that the Chinese have some European DNA or share some, for sure.
Yeah, I say we'll get into that as well, and the evidence for that over there, because there are all these dolmens over there. There's more dolmens. Well, there's half the world's dolmens actually exist in North Korea. And dolmens are clearly put up by white people. It's the megaliths that we have. When you have three uprights with a huge capstone on the top, that's a dolmen. It's similar to what Stonehenge looks like. We got them all over Britain.
These markers were almost prophetic, weren't they? Where, you know, the Hebrews were supposed to leave them wherever they went.
Yeah, it's all over the Old Testament. It talks about the Hebrews putting up standing stones, erecting stone circles, putting dolmens up. Abraham bought a field and then put a cave in the field. And that is one of those dolmens with the earth over it. So it talks all about them in the Old Testament, and that's proof that white people were somewhere. You've got them in India, you've got them in Persia, but half the world's dolmens are in North Korea. So we'll get to China when we get to China. But we'll just finish off here by taking a look at Ramses the Great here. Around 1279 BC, Ramses II, also known as Ramses the Great, ascended the throne and went on to build more temples, erect more statues and obelisks, and sire more children than any other pharaoh in history. A bold military leader, Ramses II led his army against the Hittites in the Battle of Kadesh in modern Syria, and after fighting to a stalemate, finally agreed to the first recorded peace treaty around 1258 BC. And I'm sure that along with that peace treaty, there will have been an exchange of women, and that really will have seen to the downfall of Egypt. It was with these exchanges with the Hittite princesses. But Ramses II himself, his face has just been reconstructed from his mummy, and he is clearly a white man, looking no different to any other white man of today. Egypt's wealth at this time made it a tempting target for invasion, particularly by the Libyan Berbers to the west, and the Sea Peoples, who were made up of Aryans and Canaanites, a conjectured confederation of seafarers coming from the Aegean Sea. Initially, the military were able to repel these invasions, but Egypt eventually lost control of its remaining territories in southern Canaan, that's the bit right near to Egypt, with much of it falling to the Assyrians. The effects of external threats were exacerbated by internal problems such as corruption, tomb robbery, civil unrest, and remember, this comes after the peace treaty with the Hittites and taking some of their women, and also having the Nubian slaves and the Hyksos slaves amongst the population. After regaining their power, the high priests at the Temple of Amun in Thebes were able to accumulate vast tracts of land and wealth, and their expanded power splintered the country during the Third Intermediate Period, which continued up to 700 BC, where war between Egypt and Assyria became inevitable, and some of the details of what happened there are told in the biblical books of Jeremiah and Isaiah. So it was really all downhill from Ramses II. I think that was the high point there. But there's been ups and downs all along from the first multicultural bit with the Hyksos until they expelled the Hyksos, and then they had some time again when they were building up with Amenophis, or after Akhenaten, and they were rebuilding themselves up again, rebuilding themselves up to here, and then it all went downhill again.
Mm-hmm.
After Go on.
No, I was just going to make a point, history repeating, that's all.
Yeah, it does that. I mean, that's what we're really learning with this, isn't it? That history goes in cycles and there's nothing new under the sun. After defeating Egypt, the Assyrians left control of the country to a series of vassals. But in 525 BC, the powerful Persians, led by Cambyses II, began their own conquest of Egypt, eventually capturing the pharaoh Psamtik III at the Battle of Pelusium. Cambyses II then assumed the formal title of pharaoh, but ruled Egypt from Persia, leaving Egypt under the control of a satrap. A few successful revolts against the Persians marked the 5th century BC, but Egypt was never able to permanently overthrow them. Following its annexation by Persia, Egypt was joined with Cyprus and Phoenicia in the 6th satrapy of the Achaemenid Persian Empire. The first period of Persian rule over Egypt, also known as the 27th dynasty, ended in 402 BC, when Egypt regained independence under a series of native dynasties. The last of these dynasties, the 30th, proved to be the last royal house of ancient Egypt, ending with the kingship of Necténebo II. And I just have to pause there. I don't know if you want to say something, Patriarch?
The Persians. I mean, we've only just touched on them, haven't we, here? I just wonder what they would have been up to prior to this sort of coming into conflict with Egypt.
I think we're going to have to do an episode on that. I mean, we did talk about them a little bit around about the time we were talking about the flood, weren't we? Because they were sort of just up above Sumeria. And also these Achaemenids, they were Shemites as well. And it was this Achaemenid Persian Empire that allowed the tribe of Judah to go back to Israel and rebuild the Jerusalem. And that was the reason why, because the Persians were descendants of Shem. So they were part of the original same ethnicity as the Israelites. Where do we get to here? Ending with the kingship of Necténebo II. There was a brief restoration of Persian rule, sometimes known as the 31st dynasty, which began in 343 BC. But shortly after, in 332 BC, the Persian ruler Mazaces handed Egypt over to Alexander the Great without a fight, as he was seen as being a liberator from the dreaded Persians. And that's who we're going to look into in the next episode. Have you got anything you want to bring up about today's episode at all, or maybe looking forward to Alexander the Great?
Yeah, definitely looking forward to that. I mean, he's an iconic hero, really, for Europe. And as we'll see next week, the extent of his rule and how it really helped Europe in establishing itself as great power in later centuries.
Yeah, I think what he set up, I mean, it lasted right the way through into the Byzantine Empire. I really didn't know that much about him. I'd read about him in Josephus, and we'll cover that. And we've got notes from a few different places that we'll get into in Alexander. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to learning more about him. But we'll leave that here for today then. So thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.